WNYC receives support from
the law firm of Cowan, Leibowitz & Latman, focusing on intellectual property and international trade, as well as general business, real estate, and litigation. Cowan advises clients in industries as diverse as fashion, finance, and food. More at CLL.com. Cultural arts partner, the Queens Museum of Art, presenting the Real Pepsi Challenge, Breaking the Color Barrier in American Business, an exhibition about how one company created an all-black sales team to market their product to the African-American community. Details, queensmuseum.org.
This is Brian Lehrer, and we're live at the Democratic Convention all this week. Every morning at 10, we'll have major newsmakers, delegates from across America, plus excerpts from the major speakers, and you on the phones and on our comments page. What is the state of the Democratic Party? Join me live from Denver at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org.
Several years ago, the Guggenheim Museum received an unusual donation, one of Ad Reinhardt's famous black paintings, so severely damaged that it could not be exhibited. Their mandate was to use the painting to learn how to conserve and restore minimalist and monochromatic paintings, and the results have been documented in a fascinating new exhibit called Imageless, the scientific study and experimental treatment of an Ad Reinhardt black painting. It is on view through September 14th, and I'm pleased to welcome Carol Stringari, chief conservator at the Guggenheim and the organizer of this exhibit, to my show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Thank you very much for having me.
So how did the Guggenheim come to receive this Ad Reinhardt black painting, which is dated 1960 to 1966? I can't believe it took him 6 years to paint it.
Well, the way that it was, that it came into the collection, was an unfortunate incident that happened when it was exhibited in Europe, and something fell on it, and there were numerous damages, scratches. There was an unsuccessful attempt. Well, there were several unsuccessful attempts to restore the painting in Europe, and then it was sent back to the States. And after much ado, I think it was in the insurance machine for many years.
And the art insurance company declared it unrepairable and paid off the claim.
Exactly. They paid the entire value of the painting to the owner, and it became valueless, essentially.
Well, what happens with a painting like that? Do people just simply throw it away?
Well, that's an interesting question, because this is one of the first opportunities we've had to study a painting like this. And I think what happens is either they're destroyed, because either the artist wants them destroyed or the estate wants them destroyed, or even because they've paid out the entire value of the painting, they have to be destroyed. Other times, I think that they are recirculated into the market. If they're not too bad, they're sold as damaged goods.
So what was your reaction when you received this donation? Did you think that it was unsalvageable?
Well, unsalvageable, yes. I thought it was unsalvageable.
You thought there was no way that you could return this to anything that would approximate what Ad Reinhardt had done originally.
Well, I think what happened was it came to us, and there were these large damages. And I've worked on many Reinhardt paintings. I've been studying Reinhardt for many, many years.
He presents special problems, doesn't he?
He presents special problems, along with many other minimalist and monochromatic painters. Although the techniques are different, the issues become the same, that you have these flat, uninflected surfaces that when they're damaged in, and you're trying to recreate that surface from even the most adept hand, you can see from some angle that it's been restored.
Now, Ad Reinhardt used to restore his own paintings. I remember him telling me, I studied with him, that a fair amount of his studio time was spent in fixing up pictures that have been sent back to him by museums or galleries, because people felt this uncontrollable urge to touch the surface because it was so beautiful and so velvety. And all you had to do is touch the surface, you destroyed it. So he was his own restorer. But was he able to do it in a way that people could not recognize that it wasn't the original?
He actually did spend a lot of time restoring his paintings, and he writes about it and talks about it, and I've gone through all of the Jewish Museum records, and it's clear that many of those works were touched or had small damages, went back to his studio and were repainted. In fact, the painting that we have has 9 layers of paint from just Reinhardt, and then it has restoration layers that are above it. But so he, in fact, must have restored that painting, because many of the paintings that we see don't have that many Reinhardt layers on them. And I think it was, he did it for the most part, I think, in the same manner that he made the painting. So there was no difference. And in some cases, we've analyzed some works where he's had to go back and put a ground on the top. So basically restarting the painting because he couldn't get it to absorb properly. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the biggest issues with the way he painted.
Because he took all the oil out of the oil paint.
Yes.
He came up with this fabulously sensuous, velvety surface for a guy who was painting the ultimate black painting. The paintings are incredibly sensuous.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's the irony of it. And it's been, I mean, I've been fascinated now for, 20 years about this interest in purity and this interest in what you might call classical painting in many ways. I mean, he was, still working with a brush in his studio by himself. He wasn't working with industrial techniques or having someone else create his paintings. And he came up with this almost meditative process where he poured turpentine over his paints and extracted the oil binder, and thus was painting with something with mostly pigment, a very rich, dense pigment, and achieved these marvelous surfaces. And I understand why people wanted to fondle them, because they were, in fact, very sensual.
Now, the painting you say, the painting that you got, had been restored by others as well. They'd put acrylics on top of this. So was the painting, even before it was damaged by something falling on top of it, was it still a Reinhardt or was it something else?
Well, I think that's still to be discussed, and we discuss it with scholars and artists and other conservators, and I feel very strongly that sensuous matte surface that he was trying to achieve was pretty important. I can't imagine that someone would do that.
But why would a restorer put acrylics on top of an oil painting? That is something that you're told you should never do.
Well, it's not even so much the acrylics, but the fact that they were sprayed on this painting makes it that much worse.
Who was doing the restoring? Jules Olitsky?
So, we could see that under the ultraviolet light when it arrived, and it was a very thick layer of transparent sort of what we call Roplex, which is an acrylic plastic, basically, which you use for Mod Podge as well as artist techniques. My guess is that it was already damaged, that it had all kinds of scratches and scrapes, and at the time, I think people felt it was more important to have a pristine painting. And I really don't think that it was meant in any malicious way. I think that people felt this painting needs to be pristine.
Well, you are the chief conservator of the Guggenheim, and you must think a lot about when restoring a painting makes it into something other than the original. How do you work that ethical line?
Mm-hmm. Well, that ethical line is a very important aspect of what we do. We are bound by a code of ethics that was established by our professional organization, and it does mandate that we retain the integrity of a work, and if we do anything, that it needs to be reversible. Well, in the case,
the old line was first, do no harm, and second, do nothing that can't be undone.
Right. Now, the idea of reversibility is being discussed all the time, because, in fact, many of the things we do are not reversible. However, many of the treatments that we do are reversing old treatments on works from from all centuries and all periods and all types of techniques. So we are very, very conscious of what we do to a painting.
I spoke last year with the conservator at the Museum of Modern Art, where they had sent one of their water lilies to a major show. And when it was shown with other water lilies, they realized that theirs had been seriously retouched to a point where it didn't look like the other Monets. And then they had to spend an awful lot of time reversing what had been done. But they had thought it was perfectly fine until they saw it in the context of the other paintings.
Mm-hmm. I actually was working at the Museum of Modern Art at that time, and there was a whole team of us working on it. And I was, I think, on the assembly line taking the glue off. And yes, in fact, when we have exhibitions and we get to compare paintings to other paintings, then we begin to realize, you know, where the artist was going. That's not to say that artists don't do things that are outside of the realm of you know, what they do every day. I think experimentation is a big part of...
Jackson Pollock painted every painting a little differently.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, we've been making mock-ups for years of Reinhardt's, and it is extraordinarily difficult to paint a Reinhardt. And every single time you do it with the same paints, the same technique, it dries differently, it looks different, you have more color, less color, and it's fascinating. I can see how he was, you know, searching for this essence and this perfect timelessness, so to speak, that he would achieve by using this method over and over again.
He wanted a timelessness, but he painted paintings that were so vulnerable to damage that they almost can't be timeless unless you do some extraordinary things to protect them.
Well, we do them now. In fact, and, you know, he actually was aware of this, and he did things like put covers on the paintings, and he put backings on the paintings, and he put there were platforms in front of some of his very early painting exhibitions in the 60s, and that was somewhat unheard of. I mean, galleries basically put things on the walls, and they didn't think about that. He was thinking very carefully about that, so... he started that tradition in some ways for his work, but we carry it on by traveling things in travel frames, because his frame is an artist-made frame, which needs also to be conserved and preserved the way that it is intact. And, you know, we don't travel these works very often. Sometimes if we travel them, we require glazing, which means people don't want them because then they have glass over them and you can't see them.
Yes. My guest is Carol Stringari, chief conservator at the Guggenheim Museum, organizer of an exhibit called Imageless, the Scientific Study and Experimental Treatment of an Ad Reinhardt Black Painting. And by the way, we have a slideshow on our website, including photos of the cross-sections that we'll be talking about in a few moments, cross-sections that the museum did, made of the of various parts of the painting to understand just how Ed Reinhardt had done what he does. We'll also show you what the painting looks like now. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with Carol Stringari, chief conservator of the Guggenheim Museum and the organizer of a show about conservation techniques applied to modern paintings called Imageless, the Scientific Study and Experimental Treatment of an Ad Reinhardt Black Painting. And what you did was go beyond just simply looking at it and trying to figure out what happened. You actually subjected it to laser scanning. And all over the world, why did you have to travel to, where'd you go, Los Angeles, Crete, the Netherlands? Do they all have different kinds of laser equipment?
Well, it was a very interesting journey. And when AXA Insurance gave us the painting, we didn't have the funds to do such research. And we went back to them and said, well, it's fine to look at this painting, but we would like to try some experimental treatment on the paintings, because we can't even blow on our minimalist and monochromatic paintings. There's really no testing to be done. We test on mock-ups, and you have one chance at the restoration, and you can't turn back. So they funded this research project, and we tried all kinds of things that we have here available to us. And then we started to talk to people about the possibility of using lasers. Now, lasers have been in the field of conservation since the 70s.
Now, how are they used differently than X-rays?
Well, an X-ray is just an examination technique. You're looking beneath the surface, high-density materials, just like your bones will show you what is beneath the surface of the painting, the structure of the painting. That's also coupled with infrared, which is another examination technique, which will show you underdrawings or carbon-based materials. A laser actually removes material, so you know, those are non-destructive, and these are what you might call, this is a destructive.
So you're taking off a layer at a time.
You're taking off a layer at a time. It's an extraordinary technique. I knew very little about lasers when we started this, and thus we went to people who we knew had extensive experience in lasers and lasers on artwork. And there's a research facility, a small research facility in L.A., which is where we went to first look at our mock-ups and do some tests. And that was where we learned that we should probably pursue this further. We even went
Do they work the way solvents would work?
No, not at all.
So you couldn't have used lasers on the Sistine Chapel ceiling?
One of the things that I have found since I've been working with lasers is that it's very, very difficult because you have to set the parameters for your materials, your pigments, your binders. When you're working on any sort of iconographic material, you know, you're moving across someone's portrait, your pigments change every centimeter or so. The fact that the Reinhardt within one square has the same pigment and what you are trying to achieve is something that's flat and even and homogeneous overall was what made us continue to look at laser as a possibility.
Well, you took off all the acrylic, I assume.
Well, all we've done at this point, and the reason why we purposely pulled that painting away from the Reinhardt paintings because it is in a state of testing. We have left all of the Reinhardt surface intact. The 9 layers of Reinhardt are there and to be uncovered or restored at some point. And what we have done is tried various lasers on the surface, and we have in the bottom right of the painting we have cleaned 2 entire squares down to the sealant layer, which is what the restorer must have put on in order to spray on top of it. And what we learned is that you can take off, you know, one layer of a paint film is about 10 microns, and you can actually set the laser to take off a micron at a time. So you're really working with a tremendous amount of control.
It's almost like CSI for a painting.
Well, exactly, yeah.
And you do have a wonderful video in the show that documents this process, which comes across as something of a scientific detective story.
Well, yeah, in some ways it is, because we weren't even sure what wavelength laser would work on such a thing at the beginning. So we really had to go through a lot of testing in order to come to some conclusions.
You have a gallery of pristine Reinhardts in the show for comparison. Have they been restored at all? Do you know?
None of them have been restored. There's a painting that has had a very subtle restoration done on some fine crackle ore that is across the surface of the central part of the painting. Because of that crackle ore, the painting has been exhibited very few times, and so it has this incredibly beautiful surface. So we decided that we were going to show that painting because it is such an amazing surface that hasn't been touched.
Do you think now you could recreate a Reinhardt surface? Do you know enough based on what you've learned from doing this?
Well, I think we're pretty close. I mean,
If a whole bunch of Reinhardt forgeries come out, are you going to be the Van Meegeren of Ed Reinhardt?
I doubt it. But I think, you know, he said, if you paint it, it's your painting. And when I paint it, it's my painting. And it's the last painting that anybody can paint. I mean, the whole concept of it is that maybe everyone should try it. So
It's very difficult, obviously.
It is extremely difficult.
But what are the problems you had to overcome with Ed Reinhardt's work? How do they compare with the problems posed by other modern contemporary painters that use unprimed canvas, house paints, non-permanent materials? I heard that de Kooning, some of the early de Koonings with the big blobs of paint, they kept on, as they dried, the blobs dried in the inside, they shrunk, and the painting sometimes even moved across the surface of the canvas, and painting became a different painting than the one that somebody bought. With Rothko's, where he took where he pretty much just applied almost pigment to the canvas and little else, they have a tendency to flake off because they're almost like pigment dust on that canvas.
Well, I think, you know, there's a misconception that 20th century art, I think, is falling apart. And the truth is that even an Ed Reinhardt painting, if it's taken care of, is in perfectly good condition. It has no inherent problems. It's just a very fragile painting. And we do, in fact, encounter that with many 20th century artists because they didn't use thick varnishes on top of their paintings to protect them because... you know, they were experimenting, but I've seen I think most of the paintings that we see damages on are because they've been mishandled, or they've been in bad climates, or they've been in bad storage, or the artists didn't store them properly, things like that. So, I mean, every artist has their own conservation issues. When you go to restore a painting, you do a lot of analysis on what is there, because you need to know, you know, what is there in order to know how to approach it.
And this is not a new thing. They've been restoring some Leonardo's since a few years after he painted them.
Well,
the Last
true.
Supper.
That's true.
I doubt if there is a fleck of original paint on that wall.
Well, we also discussed that. How is this monochromatic and minimalist painting different than those paintings that we're looking at, you know, at the Met that have been restored endlessly? Does it matter that it's no longer the hand of the artist? And how long does it take for us to accept that something isn't pristine any longer, or will we never accept it? But my feeling is we're already looking at Mondrians that have severe cracking and black patterns that we look right through. We're able to understand that as what it once was.
We see them as the pure paintings that were originally made in 1925 or whatever.
Right. And I think that the further we get from these minimalist and monochromatic paintings, the more accepting we are, and probably they won't be sprayed with a varnish.
There'll be a symposium open to the public on September 13th from 10 in the morning to 5 in the afternoon with a panel of Ed Reinhardt's friends, scientists, and other artists to discuss the issues that are brought up by this exhibit, some of which we have just discussed. There are details on the Guggenheim Museum's website. And my great thanks to Carol Stringari, who is the chief conservator at the Guggenheim and the organizer of the show, Imageless, the Scientific Study and Experimental Treatment of an Ed Reinhardt Black Painting, which is on view through September 14th. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.